The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
You mentioned this exchange you had with your wife, who's with us here today, by the way. Happy to have her in the studio. But he says, as we returned to America, I said to Debbie, I don't understand why the things we saw and heard are not shouted from the rooftops of every church in the world. And then she said that pastors study theology. They don't study archaeology. So why is that?
I think what happens is that when someone studies to be a pastor, they go to divinity school and they study the Bible, and particularly on the Protestant side, they develop an expertise in biblical exposition. So they will take a story out of the Bible, let's just say, for example, out of Isaiah or Jeremiah, and they're pretty good at giving the theological significance of it and perhaps applying it to what does this teach you about your life today? That's their shtick, that's their skill. So, you know, you can ask the question, well, why isn't the pastor telling you what does the political convulsions of the world have to do with your daily life and how you should think about? Well, the pastor would say, well, I don't want to go there because I don't really know. And not to mention the people in my church might disagree. So I'm reluctant to go into that minefield. And I think the same could be said about archaeology. To the pastor, it's like, and in some ways I can understand it because we were talking a moment ago about how this stuff has a lot of nuance. It's easy to get it wrong. And I think there's probably a little bit of anxiety on the part of a typical, you know, senior pastor. I don't want to go where there might be some guy sitting in the church who knows twice as much about this than I do, and I start spouting about it, and he's going to tell me, you don't know what you're talking about. So there is a avoidance of it. And that's why I think resources like this, because the nice thing, what I'm telling the pastor is not, listen, you need now to make yourself an expert about the Assyrian invasion of the Northern Kingdom. No, I'm like, you know what? I've got 12 10-minute videos, and they each cover an episode of biblical history. If you're going to be teaching about this period, why not just show the video? And that gives people a sort of historical and archaeological context, and then give your sermon.
So those roll out on PragerU, is that right? The 10-minute videos?
Right.
Has that started yet, or
no? That will all happen in a kind of blitzkrieg in October.
Okay.
And I think I would also like to get this to thousands of churches around the world, just basically saying, here's a free resource for you. Use it as needed. And the nice thing about it, you know, you don't have to subject. Obviously, I'd like people to watch the 2-hour documentary. So, you know, movie night at the church would work great. But the other ways, even integrated into a Wednesday church service or a youth service or a Sunday service, is here's a short video. I'm going to be talking about King David. Here's a little bit about David that you might want to know that has only been discovered really in the last 25 years.
I do think it is phenomenally powerful for people to experience the archaeology of the Bible, even if it is through these videos or even as you travel to Israel. Like, it does, as much as we think that we can just read the text, and I think it's sufficient in itself, to travel there or to recognize the archaeology of these discoveries that are being made, that puts bones on the stories, it gives it a realism that impacts us in a powerful way. Like, I don't, everyone's reading of the Bible would be impacted positively by a basic understanding of the geography and archaeology of the Holy Land. Like, it can't but increase the realism of the text.
You know what? The way I look at it is that from the 19th century all the way to now, there has been a kind of educated man skepticism that is promoted. And it started out in the university, but most people today who see themselves as sort of sophisticated people have some version of this belief, mm-hmm. and that is that the Bible was written hundreds of years after the events it purports to describe. Consequently, if not made up out of whole cloth, it is at least a highly embellished account. Large parts of it are read like parables. Now, there's enough in the Bible that tends to sort of confirm this, right? You have David fighting Goliath, and you have Samson pulling down the walls of the temple, and you have Balaam talking to his donkey. That it's easy to go, oh, that sounds right, you know. Now, the archaeology kicks back, I think, here in a very decisive way, because when you take a minor character, for example, you know, two of the guys that King Zedekiah rounds up, Jehuchal, son of Shelemiah, and, you know, Gedaliah, son of Pashur, he says, go keep an eye on Jeremiah, right? So these guys have a fairly minor role, and yet you have seals that have their names on it. And it's pretty unmistakably those guys. And so then you ask yourself, well, what are the chances that somebody making this stuff up 300 years later or 500 years later would know who are the, like, administrative assistants in the court of King Zedekiah? It's impossible to know that. This has to have come from people who were there. Now, even if it was written later, it could be that the source material came down, but the source material is from people who were there. One of the articles that you guys did, which I cite, I thought it was very brilliant, is it was an article looking at the Exodus. And of course, as I was thinking of a chapter on the Exodus, I was thinking to myself, well, I'm going to have to look in Egypt for evidence of the Israelites. And there is some of that, but not as much as you would want. Mm-hmm. And then I come across your article, which goes, there's another way to look at this, and scholars are doing this, and you profile a couple of them. They look for Egypt in the Bible. The idea being that if the Israelites were never in Egypt, the guys who wrote the Bible wouldn't know anything about Egypt. They would state all kinds of things about Egypt that would be based upon ignorance of what Egypt is really like. But when you look at the detail that is in the Bible about Egypt, it is quite obvious that the writer was there. Mm-hmm. He knows the kind of stuff that people eat. He knows how slaves, you know, make bricks. He knows some of the geographical conditions. He knows what type of birds are flying overhead. And he couldn't know those things if he wasn't there. So this is all, I think what's nice about this is the way that the reasonable man, just think of what someone does in a jury, right? You make a reasonable man's assessment of who's telling the truth. And that's the standard I use in making the case here. It's kind of a colloquial way of talking. I always assume that my reader knows nothing, but is also really smart. So you have to explain it, but if you do explain it, they would get it. And that's also, by the way, the same approach we use for films. Because you think about it, some films are quite complex. They rely on very subtle hints that are dropped in the film for revelations to come later. And yet the audience, which is not necessarily a group of people from the Mensa high IQ society, can nevertheless sit down in a theater in a dark room and figure it out, even though the material is quite complex. And so I think this operating assumption is a good way to present information.
So is there a theatrical release for the two-hour version as well, like in theaters?
Not in theaters, because I think it is... I would put it, the documentary is sort of an edutainment. Mm-hmm. It doesn't fit the requirements of a movie, because in a movie, you need a single arc, you need a single theme, you need an unfolding plot. I will admit that these rules are violated. When Al Gore made An Inconvenient Truth, it's basically a two-hour lecture by Al Gore with background images of penguins and, you know, ice flows melting and things like that. So it's a horrible movie. It's not something that normally should have been released in the theater, but of course it was propaganda. They were pushing it out.
Right.
This is something I want to make available to people who want to learn more. We'll make trailers and things to promote it. But the idea here is to use the vast resources of online to get it seen in many countries and by just millions of people.
Yeah. What would you say the project has done, leaving aside the scholarship and what you've learned about archaeology? How do you think, how has it impacted just your thinking about the Bible and the teachings of the Bible?
It has greatly sort of consoled me in the knowledge that the Bible can be taken as an historical account. And I say this is important because one could make a pretty strong case for the Bible that didn't even go there. You could say, listen, the Bible doesn't purport to be a science book or a history book. It unfolds a series of stories that are aimed at giving you moral lessons and showing you a recipe for salvation. And that's what the Bible is, and that's what you should take it for. And there's no reason to ask, was Job a real historical person? And, you know, is where he lived, is that a real place that you could find on a map? That's no more important than trying to figure out, you know, locate, say, ancient Troy as a way of reading the Trojan War, because the Trojan War is a great epic. It's a wonderful story. Whether or not it actually happened does very little to diminish or even add to the power of the tale. But of course, the great difference between Homer's epic and the Bible is that the Bible is God's word. It's revealed truth. And so I think it's particularly for me exhilarating to be able to make the case and demonstrate these historical episodes in the Bible. The Bible is not necessarily trying to give you the comprehensive history. It's also giving you, I would call it, perspectival history, right? So it's history from the point of view of the Israelites. One of the cool things about the archaeology, and I'm telling you things you already know, but nevertheless, is that when you look, for example, at, you know, the Moabite stone, for instance, you begin to see an episode in the Bible, and not only is the historicity of the Bible affirmed, but you now see it from the Moabite side. And so you get two different perspectives, which enriches your understanding. And not only that, there's things on the Moabite stone that aren't mentioned in the Bible. So now you actually get Bible plus. And I think the two, the history and the biblical account, like beautifully enhance each other. And so for me, this is a way to develop a deeper respect for the Bible and for the Bible as a reliable and, in fact, an inspired document.
Do you believe that the Bible is inspired by God and revealed from God?
Yes. I believe that the Bible is written by human hands, but right. Those humans are inspired by God. So it is an inspired work from start to finish.
You talked earlier about just the scholars that attack the Bible when they don't attack the Quran and other religious texts. I mean, what you said right there, that seems like that would put you, you know, right at odds with a lot of, you know, scholarship in this world. And it's great. It sounds like you're going forward fearlessly, and that's what you should do if that's what you believe.
A lot of the scholarship, unfortunately, I think today is contaminated by politics in the broadest sense. Sometimes it's politics in the narrow sense, where they'll say things like, you can't do any archaeology in the West Bank because anything you find is going to demonstrate the presence of the Jews in this part of the country, and we're supposed to be conceding this to the Palestinians. And so you actually have, I've heard from sources close to the Israeli Antiquities Authority, like, it's not that the government of Israel says you can't do it, but if you do it, archaeological journals will turn you down because they frown upon doing work in that area for political reasons. But I think there's also a broader small p politics, which is things like all religions deserve equal respect. These different religious belief systems are sort of equally false or equally true. They should be all treated as kind of myths that help people to live better lives. And so anything that says, for example, that, hey, the Bible can withstand archaeological scrutiny and no other religious document can, that's considered like fighting words to say that. And yet, what I like about it is it's so obviously true. Because show me the, 200 archaeological studies of the Quran. Regardless of whether they say it's true or false, where are they at all? Who's even attempting this? And so it's pretty revealing that the skepticism, somebody made the observation that even atheism today, for example, is always aimed at the monotheistic God, right? You don't find atheists arguing about polytheism or trying to refute whether Jove was real or Zeus or Athena. It's all aimed at the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And that alone is very telling because the atheists think that if there is any God, that's the one guy we need to bring down. They know their enemy, so to speak.
Much has been made of, particularly during President Trump's terms, about so-called religious resurgence, maybe more so just here in America. And we've been pretty critical on this program about just the shallowness of it. What's your take on some of these reports that you hear, like, oh, Bibles are selling off now and young people are more interested in the Bible? Do you feel like that there's a depth there as far as Christianity goes?
I think that there is a widespread sense in our society that something has gone fundamentally wrong, and not just wrong in the micro sense that we'd have our economic policy doesn't work. It's that our society has been kind of gotten out of whack in a fundamental way, and so there's a reassessment for sure. The problem is, I think that the church, speaking broadly, is not up to that moment of speaking to that in a very layered way. So by and large, in churches, you will get a roundabout message that always converges on kind of the same thing, which is kind of accept Jesus. There might be some kind of practical lesson that has been excavated out of the text. And that's kind of the end of it.
We've kind of picked apart some of the Trump administration, their pursuit of peace. They talk a lot about, this peace deal. And I think the most like flip-flopping we've seen is with Iran more recently. One day it's a peace agreement, and then the next day, there's more bombs being dropped. What's your, just from a biblical perspective, Jesus said a lot in the Olivet Prophecy about the last days, and Paul wrote about it in 2 Timothy 3. What you mentioned earlier, that there's this sense that the world is sort of off track. Like, what's your sense of the world at large, the way it is, why it is the way it is, why there's so much fighting, so much warring, and so much basically tribulation?
I think the clues in Matthew 24 that talk about the end times, if you go through them sort of methodically, and you have to do it cautiously because we have seen in earlier ages, people will look at those same phrases like wars and rumors of wars. And think about it, if you are living through World War I, you're going to go, wars and rumors of wars. Well, right, what are we've got a world war going on for the first time. So obviously this tells you that the world is close to coming to an end. But that's one sign. Some of the signs that I think are kind of interesting and worth thinking about, that in the last days, knowledge is available to the full reach of the earth. In other words, when Jesus comes again, for example, every eye will see him. Well, that would have been hard to do in like 1910, right? But we happen to live in a time where, by and large, the world can in fact see the same thing simultaneously in one glance. And that's the product and fruit of modern technology. Now, is that what the Bible was referring to? Hard to know. But it's not a bad idea to think about that a little bit. with Trump, you know, I did a monologue on my show a couple of months ago where I described him as the real estate president. And what I meant by this is that Trump is transactional. He has a great difficulty understanding human motivation that is somehow ideological. And this applies just as much to communists in Venezuela as it does to, Islamists in Gaza. The way Trump looks at it, human beings want to make their lives better. And so he looks at Gaza and some of his more outlandish statements where he says, well, I don't see why it can't be a Riviera. People laugh and they go, I can't believe he said that. But I think the way Trump looks at it is like, I'm a real estate guy. This is a pretty important location. And why can't we have like nice buildings here and coffee shops and maybe a Trump hotel and people going to high-tech firms and artificial intelligence and self-driving cars? So I think Trump starts there. He's like, how do I make deals with people who obviously have the same general motivations I do? I offer them a better life. This is a better way to live than you're living now, isn't it? And if someone were to say to Trump, I prefer death to life, Trump has a great deal of difficulty with that guy because he doesn't know how to talk to that guy. He doesn't even know what's driving that guy. So that's why Trump will say something like, oh, the Iranians, I mean, these are excellent people. We can certainly sit down with them. I found them to be extremely sincere. And then 2 weeks later, you know, these people are nuts. They're out of their mind. And then someone goes, you know, they go, well, what changed? And he goes, well, I got to know them. So this is the approach of the transactional guy who is making these kinds of discoveries. Now, somebody who is studying the motivations of Islam, what these people are trying to do, what their long-term goal is, you know, that guy already knows. You can't trust the Iranians. You don't need, he doesn't need to meet these mullahs in the room to discover you can't trust these guys. In fact, they're operating out of a philosophy that says that deception in dealing with an infidel is commendable. So Trump is, in a way, coming around to that, but he doesn't start there.
Yeah. Do you feel like America, I mean, what's your sense of America's future as far as the world being off track? Is America, I mean, you were there, as were we, you know, saying that President Trump, you know, the election was stolen and he needs to come back, and now he's back. And so what's your sense of the track that America is on at the moment?
Well, you realize that something like, you know, make America great again, it's not an easy thing to do because some of our problems are run deep. The progressive hijacking of the Constitution, for example, we live in a constitutional structure that would be largely unrecognizable to the framers. Well, when did that happen? It didn't happen in the Civil War. In the Civil War, the two sides had the same deep regard for the founding. They both revered the Constitution. They disagreed on what it said, but they only disagreed on what it said on one point, which was essentially the extension of slavery. Otherwise, the North and the South, they both believed in God. They both believed in providence. They both believed that America had a sort of spiritual destiny. They both believed in the family. They both believed, by and large, in the American dream and wanted to live it out the same way. Their disagreement was far more narrow than anything that we see today. And the hijacking of our Constitution and some of the problems that we're dealing with go back to 1913 when the Federal Reserve was founded, or the progressive movement that goes back to, it was built upon later by FDR and then LBJ and Obama, but it started with Woodrow Wilson. So we're talking about problems that are at least 100 years old.
I was going to ask you too, just from your perspective, I think you came to the U.S. in 1978.
Right.
So you talked briefly there about the 250 years. What have you noticed since you got here in 1978 about just the change in direction for America?
I think the main thing I've noticed is that, and it's really shifted my career in important ways, is that in the Reagan era, I date the Reagan era from 1980 to 2008, because even though Reagan left, subsequent presidents were carried by the Reagan tide. So the Reagan era lasted 25 years. In the Reagan era, I thought, and we thought, we kind of Reaganites thought, that we have a dispute in this country, but it's not a dispute over goals or ends. It's a dispute over means. We all want to go to the same place. We all want an America that is strong, prosperous, law and order, where people can live decent lives, sense of civic community. The disagreement is not over whether we are going to Chicago, but whether we should take the bus or the train. Another way to put it is the left and the right agreed we should create a big pie, a prosperous society. Now, we can argue about how to slice up the pie, who gets, you know, a bigger piece, a smaller piece, how the prosperity is doled out, so to speak. But we agree that prosperity is the goal. We agree that free market capitalism is the way to get there. We agree that America is the exemplary society. We want other countries to take our recipe and copy it. Today, I would say the key difference, and this started under Obama, but we've seen it now for two decades, is the disagreement is now not over the means, but over the end. It's kind of like, we're going to Maine, they want to go to Chicago. It's no longer a matter of taking the bus or the train. We're going to two different places. We want two different societies. And that creates problems that are far more intractable.
Mm-hmm. So do you feel like, just going back to President Trump and his administration and the direction of the country, what about with respect, you mentioned Reagan, you worked in the Reagan administration. What have you observed, just comparing that, let's say, with President Trump's administration with respect to Israel and just the rising tide of Jew hatred that we're seeing in the world today? You just talked earlier about how impactful going to Israel and getting into archaeology has been. And here again, the level of resistance against the Jewish state and in a lot of ways, even Jews is... For us, it's shocking to see some that are in powerful positions even that are sort of saying that we need to distance ourselves from Israel or our support for Israel.
I mean, I'm struck, and what you're saying is a good example of this, at how palpable and obvious the presence of evil is in our world now. When Reagan gave his famous Evil Empire speech, I believe this was 1983, there was an electric shock that went through the country that he even used the term evil. Even though communism is evil, the general critique of communism was it doesn't work, it is oppressive. But just bringing in this kind of theological and moral idea that the free world stands for good, and these people, their whole system is evil, that was seen as a very combative thing to say. But I'm struck by how today, in normal discourse, we see things every day, both in ordinary life and also in politics, where there's no other word for this than just downright evil. So the kind of Satan's active hand in the world is much more evident, I think, in this time than it was in the last part of the 20th century. Even though the 20th century had these great evils of Nazism and then communism, in some ways you could say that those were crushed, right? Nazism was reduced to ashes, communism imploded by the end of the century. So there was a mood of optimism around the turn of the millennium, and much of that has dissolved and been replaced by, I think, a dark sense that there are... evil forces. I mean, when I went to this anti-Semitism conference in January, I would talk to secular Jews, and they would be like, oh, the Jews have been hated from the beginning of time. And I would say to them, why is that? And I realized that a lot of them would say, I don't know. Think about it. This is a topic that you think about every day. It's something that, according to you, has been occurring from the beginning of history, and you have no good explanation for it. Because the secular explanations, which are things like, well, people envy the Jews, they're obviously doing really well, so people are jealous. That might be true at a certain time or place, but could it really be true that in Tsarist Russia, were the Jews all that powerful and all, were they running everything? No, they were in, you know, fiddler on the roof style, living in little, you know, hamlets and farms, and they were not a powerful group. And the Tsar could swat them down anytime he wanted to, and there was no question of there being a lot of envy directed at these people. And yet anti-Semitism, pogroms, all the signature targeting of the Jews was there too. So what is the explanation if the secular explanation is insufficient? And I think this is where you have to look for transcendental explanations.
What about, you mentioned like Nazism was crushed following World War II. You probably talked, since you were here in 2024, you probably talked a fair bit about October 7. I can't remember everything we discussed, but do you feel like the response, and it's not like it's just been America, but America has been involved with Gaza to some extent, much more so with Iran, but have those evil regimes been crushed, or have they been dealt with and maybe not completely stamped out to where, you know, there's going to be at some point another October 7th?
The aspect of October 7th that I think is chilling in comparison even to the Nazis is the gleeful broadcasting of the atrocities, right? We know from the Nazis that even the Nazis didn't do that. They were, whether out of a sense of shame or perhaps more likely, we don't want to have to defend these things, even to the German people. Let's put the death camps outside of Germany, in occupied Poland, for example. So contrast this behavior with Hamas live streaming its atrocities and the phone call. We played this in my film, The Dragon's Prophecy, where this guy is boasting to his mom and dad that he's killed 10 Jews with his own hands. And you might expect his parents to be appalled, but no, they're just downright delighted. Put mom on the phone. You know, this is the tone. Allahu Akbar. No, that force has not only not been defeated, it is a force that is on the resurgence. After its great setback with the end of the Ottoman Caliphate. And so that's a force I think we're going to be dealing with for a while.
Are you surprised by the change in some conservative commentators or even Trump administration officials about the approach or stance toward Israel?
I think the surprise is that there was evidently a kind of deep hatred of Israel and the Jews in some people that we had no idea it was there. And I say that because if you take as a representative figure Tucker Carlson, I'll pick Tucker only because Candace is too easy a target. Tucker is sort of someone who is a smart guy, was doing really good monologues on Fox, and had a genuine impact, and I think for the good. Now, if you look at Tucker, it's not as if the Tucker of now emerged immediately, like full-blown. It was in stages. And the way I track it is like this. It started out with Netanyahu bad. I'm only critiquing the Israeli government. Then it went to Israel bad. I'm criticizing the state of Israel. Then it went to Jews bad. And then a key turn, Islam good. Hamas not so bad. Sharia not so bad. Bin Laden not so bad. The Iranian regime pretty good. So this is it's almost as if the fulcrum of Jews and Israel has flipped Tucker's whole perspective on its head. So the things that he unhesitatingly would have said after 9/11, he did say, not just that he would have said, he did say, he is now forced to repudiate. It's similar to a guy who has undergone a conversion that started out by turning on one point, but then the whole your whole global perspective turns because of that.
Do you think those kinds of influencers, if I can call them that, are in the Trump administration that have made those kinds of turns?
Well, I think that there are some people in the Trump administration who have that general orientation. Some of it could just be opportunistic. In other words, they go, hey, Tucker's got a following. We don't want to alienate that following. We need those people's votes. It's not exactly like we have a luxury of huge margins in the House or the Senate. So we need to keep these people in our coalition. That could be part of it. And so I think there is some of that. Some of it is just extension of the conspiracy thinking that was validated in the COVID era. In other words, a lot of public agencies have been lying to us, right? They lied to us about masks, and they lied to us about social distancing, and they lied to us about whether you could take the vaccine and give COVID or get COVID. And so people began to distrust the NIH and the CDC and the FBI. And so that receptivity to conspiratorial thinking, I think, got reinforced. And then along came the Tuckers of the world who said, and guess what? Not only are all these puppeteers manipulating you, but there is a master manipulator, the puppeteer of the puppeteers, and that's Israel. The Jews are behind it all. And then some people went, ooh, that's a big one. We never thought about it that way, but wow, Tucker's onto something really big. So I think if this had been tried 20 years ago, people would be like, that's ridiculous. Even look at some of Candace's theories in the wake of the Charlie Kirk assassination. They're so outlandish. You wonder how people who are like not confined in asylums would believe them. Mm-hmm. But evidently there are enough people who think that it's at the very least interesting and that she's a genuine sleuth pursuing the truth.
Yeah, and here there's information everywhere, and so much of it is in the category of conspiracy and deception and lies. And it's quite the paradox. All of the progress, quote unquote, we've made with technological advances, and yet we're seeing evil spread so much quicker than it used to because of technology.
Well, I think the other factor is that if you look at the conservative movement, when I was in my early 20s and 30s, the conservative movement had gatekeepers. A good example of a gatekeeper would be like William F. Buckley or Irving Kristol. And these were kind of the smart elder statesmen of the movement. And their job was to keep out the lunatics. And so if somebody said something like, you know, not just that Eisenhower was wrong, but that Eisenhower is an agent of the Soviet Union, Buckley would say, well, you're not welcome to publish in the National Review because you're nuts. You're not a reputable conservative. And while that kind of power can be abused, you do want to have a wide swath of ideas. It had the value of expelling, you know, nut jobs. The problem is now not only that we don't have the gatekeepers, but we don't even have a genuine conservative intelligentsia. So that you have these self-styled influencers. I mean, even that term is kind of revealing, right? And who is to arbitrate among these influencers? No one. So your only measure of success is how big is your following. Like how many people clicked on your episode? That's the measure of whether you are successful. And so then you say to yourself, wow, what can I say that's going to get me a lot of views, a lot of clicks, and sometimes a lot of revenue that goes with that? It creates a whole different incentive structure in the culture.
It seems like, Hillary Clinton, going back to 2016, and some of the books you've had about President Trump, that you've timed them to be released right before the election. Was there anything with respect to this book, being that it's right before the midterm elections, or is that just kind of the way it unfolded?
Yeah. We're working on a project that deals with Islam in America, and that's going to be my next documentary film. But quite likely after the midterms, more kind of aimed at the future. I think we're dealing with something that is, I'm not talking now about Hamas or Boko Haram over there. I'm talking about Islam in the West, mm-hmm. in Australia, in Canada, but most of all in the United States. And the very new and peculiar challenges it poses to our generally open system of government, which does not really anticipate organized movements that will travel on the liberties offered by the Constitution, but toward a destination that would subvert those liberties. And how do we think about and how do we deal with that kind of thing? So we're working on this. But and oddly enough, this project in biblical archaeology, although its goals are biblical, historical, defense of the West, weirdly, they tie into all this because the biggest challenge, I think, to Western principles today is coming from the Islamic side. And those are the people, anyway, that have the most conviction. Mm-hmm. And so something like this is very powerful because even if you look at something like, you know, let's take the land of Israel and ask a simple question. On what basis do you decide not just whose land that is, but how any group has the title deeds to a piece of land? What makes you think that the Indians deserve India? Why do the Spaniards deserve Spain? What is their claim to that piece of land, right? And so this book makes you think about things like that. Because quite clearly, it's not simply a matter of I was there first, right? Because being there first does count for something. I mean, the American Indians were here first. They have some claim based on that. But it's not necessarily a decisive claim. If there was one oasis in the desert, right? Does the first Bedouin who gets to that oasis own the oasis? Can he then say, all right, anybody else who wants to drink water here has to pay me a fee because I'm here first, so it's mine? So this sort of thing is oddly enough illuminated by biblical archaeology, even though the questions behind it are very broad.
We just had our 250th anniversary of America's founding. And the previous times you've been on the program, I've loved it when you have ventured into education and history and those kinds of things. What most of it that I was observing was just kind of celebrating and having games and fun and that sort of thing. But as an academic scholar and a historian and an author, what do you feel like that as Americans, when we're coming up to a momentous anniversary such as that, that we should really be getting grounded in or looking into or studying or returning to?
Well, our celebration of America 250 is darkened by the fact that so many things in our society are awry, you know, they're off track. And recognizing how that happened, because when I first came to America, it was very easy for me to have a sort of undiluted patriotism, kind of America, rah, rah, rah. The founders are, you know, pretty much right on everything, certainly right on the formula for the best type of government. But now you have to ask a question, well, if the founders were so great, how did the society get into the position it is now? If our rights were so beautifully protected by being, you know, parachuted into the Bill of Rights, how is it that under COVID, pretty much all those rights could be trampled on? Freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom of assembly, that's just the starting point, where evidently those rights didn't count for much when it counted, when we needed them. And so this kind of examination, I'm not saying that you know, the White House has to have a scratch-your-head conference on where America went wrong, but I'm saying it needs to be a part of the overall, you're celebrating, but you're also reflecting. It's kind of like if a guy, you know, turns 40, you know, he goes, I'm now no longer as young as I thought, and I need to do a little bit of an inventory.
I just turned 40, so this is good for me.
Yeah, there you go. you celebrate it. You know, you've come a long way. You're happy with the way your life is going, but a little bit of an inventory of decisions you made, you know, what sometimes is called examination of conscience, not a bad thing, and not a bad thing for a country either.
Yeah, it sounds like you're talking about repentance, and we bring that up on this show. It's got a Bible orientation, but we feel like that amid all of the talk about the golden age and the celebrations, that there isn't enough, as you say, there isn't enough about looking at your mistakes. You know, what did we do wrong in these 250 years, as you bring out? How did we end up with these kinds of curses over COVID or whatever it was? And that's the starting point. You know, you have to examine yourself, as the Bible says, and learn from mistakes. It's not like it's all repentance, the message of the scriptures, but that certainly is a starting point for making things better in the future.
Yeah, a lot of young people today, Gen Z types, think that the golden age of America was in the 1980s. Debbie and I, we came of age in the 1980s, and there were a lot of issues we were dealing with in the 80s. We would have said in the 80s that the golden age of America was in the 1950s, because in the 1950s, America seemed to be at the zenith of its power. The American passport, the American dollar. And yet, you know, as I thought about it, it occurred to me, if the 50s were so great, how did we get the 60s? There must have been something in the 50s that was hollow or shallow, so that this kind of explosion of soul searching and rebellion, characterized by all these movements, the civil rights movement, the feminist movement, the gay rights movement, the sexual revolution, those are not things that will normally explode out of a self-contained, contented society. So there was clearly problems even then. And so as you keep going further back, you begin to realize how deep-rooted these problems are. I mean, let's go back to a problem we deal with today, which is simply the fact that our government, which spends more than it takes in, and is scared to raise taxes because people will then revolt and not vote for the politicians who raise their taxes, our government kind of got into the habit of just deciding that money can be run off a printing press. And that's not something that started with Obama. I mean, that's something that started in 1913. So we've been living with that over a century. And over that period of time, people's hard-earned savings have been not just devalued, but almost dissolved. What a dollar would buy in 1930, forget about 1930, 1980. Today, that same dollar buys only a few cents worth. So there's a lot to fix in the country. And some of it is like built into the system, which makes it really hard to fix. Like, which party today is talking about either abolishing or fundamentally reforming the Federal Reserve? Neither party. It's not even part of our debate. And yet, it's so much the root of our problems, right? Young people say, I can't buy a house. Well, why can't you buy a house? Because housing prices have gone so high. Well, does it take any more material to build a house than it did, let's say, in 1980? No. Why have housing prices gone up? And what do you mean when you say that? It's not even so much that housing prices have gone up. It's that the purchasing power of money has gone down. And why is that? So, you know, so what I'm getting at is the relevance of these issues, where people are looking at the symptom, but they're not looking at the cause.
Yeah. Well, going forward, what do you see for America, like life after President Trump? He's got a couple more years left. And maybe you could even comment on the midterms and just what sense you have of just the political direction of the country and the road forward?
I think Trump will be seen as a very significant president who stemmed a very destructive tide that all this business with the police state and the deep state and the approval of censorship and the surveillances that were going on, the political prosecutions. His presidency has thrown light on all those things in a very fundamental way. So when I look at the big sweep of things, by and large, in each of the centuries of America, you can find about three consequential presidents. You have a lot of decent middle-of-the-roaders and a few horrible ones. But in the 18th century, you know, you'd have to say Washington, Adams. Jefferson was elected in 1900, but he was a man of the 18th century. Then in the 19th century, potentially John Quincy Adams, but then, of course, Abraham Lincoln. Arguably, Polk, who doubled the size of the country. 20th century, I would say the consequential figures have been possibly Wilson, but certainly FDR and Reagan. These are the sort of dominant figures who stand out. And in the 21st century, so far, for better or worse, it's Obama and Trump. And in some ways, those are opposites. Obama's the anti-Trump. Trump is the anti-Obama. But the country's fate is still up in the air and hangs in the balance. I think it still will after Trump. Hopefully, Trump will lay the foundations for a really powerful sort of MAGA movement that will outlast him and be able to take things a lot further. That is certainly my hope.
Tonight, you and your wife are going to be viewing Celtic Throne 2. Maybe you can tell our audience, we'll circle all the way back to what you touched on at the start, your experience or history with Celtic Throne.
Well, I have to sort of hand it to you guys because when I first came here and I encountered your work in biblical archaeology, I was like, what are the odds that a bunch of guys in Oklahoma are like at the frontier of biblical archaeology in America, are actively involved in these digs, and are putting out really valuable information? I was like, gotta hand it to them. They're doing amazing stuff here by any way of looking at it. And then, almost like out of nowhere, you're like, come, let's watch this Celtic Throne. And I thought, okay, well, this is going to be, you know, kind of quaint and amusing, and it's really nice to have a lot of people get up on stage and belt out a few songs. And I was just so startled at the brilliance of it and the quality of it, the music. And not only that, but it's one thing to take, you know, 8 professionals and put them up on a stage. It's another thing to put 100 people on the stage, which includes entire families and kids, and somehow it all works. And you're kind of left a little speechless. So here you have excellence in two utterly unrelated areas, right? On the one hand, we're talking about the Tell Dance Deli. On the other hand, you're talking about Irish dance. So it's just such a unlikely and startling area to, so I was just so struck by it, and I've been looking for a way to come see it again. And of course, Debbie hasn't seen it the first time, so we're very excited, and I'm actually thrilled that it's a new variation, and I know it's going to be great. And so we went to see Riverdance recently, by the way. And this was a whole generation after Debbie had seen the original one with Flatley. And while Riverdance is technically spectacular, the actual storyline and plot is a bit of a nothing burger, you know? And so I think that I actually expect, and this is not just I hope, but based on experience, that this is going to be a more enjoyable performance. And think of, that says a lot.
Well, we appreciate you joining us today for the conversation, and I hope you and your wife have a wonderful evening tonight.
Thank you.